Welcome to the B-Side. It is Tyler here, joined as always by Pastor Steve. Crushing it today. Another podcast for you. Glad you have joined us. We are on a consistent streak, and I'm loving it. I hope you are as well. Please continue to send your questions in. B-side at tachurch.ca. The email thing is so in my head. I just am like so rattled that I almost every single time I try to say it, I screw it up. But if you don't know it by now, you should.
So, B-side.
B-side.
At tachurch.ca.
So what are we doing? The B-side. Where are we? We're at TA Church.
The back room.
In the back room.
The room I affectionately call...
The studio.
The studio, which no one knows what I'm talking about.
And most of us call...
The storage room.
Storage room.
Stop putting stuff in the studio.
Or...
Every time I come in, there's a box spring in here. And I don't know why.
I don't know either. I'll have to ask Paul. Paul, that's the great thing about Paul.
Did you know?
He has the answers to most of the questions.
Did you know that Paul actually owns the church?
Really?
Yeah, I think it's if you found the deed, it just says Paul.
Yeah, could be.
Wouldn't
surprise me.
That's not true.
No, it's not. I'm pretty sure the denomination
metaphorically
has the deed.
He should own the church.
Yeah, he owns it in the metaphorical sense. Anyway, we love Paul. Paul, are you listening? If you are, give us a high five. He's too busy probably to listen to
him. He's too important.
And he knows all this stuff anyway.
He's probably too important.
Yeah. We are glad that you are here listening and hope you find these helpful. So today...
We've got a good question.
We do have a really good question. And I think it'd be helpful for all of us to consider is that recently we're kind of... Now we're picking up steam in our reading plan through Joshua. But one of the common... protests or objections to Christianity that people will make quite regularly is about God and his character. And they'll often say things like, the Bible seems to paint this picture of God as this kind of genocidal maniac who uses his power and his people to just kind of wipe out
the Canaanites
and the Amalekites and Philistines or whoever they seem to be in conflict with. And in the first few chapters of Joshua, we kind of see that happen, that the people of Israel enter the land and then they quickly kind of just annihilate the Canaanites. So how should we, think about God in this context, and is it accurate? Is God, for lack of a better term, genocidal in his desire to wipe out people groups?
I mean, that's the accusation. But I actually want to question that picture by actually looking at what... There's some things we need to take into account. I mean, this is one of the big objections of the new atheism. Like, Richard Dawkins talks like this quite a bit, is that God is genocidal, the God of the Bible is genocidal, and Christians condemn genocide, therefore Christians should condemn the God of the Bible.
Right.
It's sort of his... So it's a common question that people have, or as far as skeptics.
Yeah. I mean, for a smart guy, it sounds like a pretty weak rhetoric, but...
But the question is what kind of God is this? And so, first thing I'll say is, if you wonder about this, I would so highly recommend a book that you need to read called The Skeletons in God's Closet by a guy named Joshua Ryan Butler. The subtitle is The Mercy of Hell, The Surprise of Judgment, and The Hope of Holy War. And he looks at these three big issues, hell, judgment, and holy war, or conquest, and exposes that the view that a lot of people have of them is wrong. It's a misguided caricature, an exaggeration. It doesn't deal with the text well, so he looks closely at the texts. What do they actually say? Because what people think they say is not accurate. What do they actually say? What are they actually teaching? And then showing how actually the God of the Bible, that these things that hell, judgment, and holy war are actually good news, not bad news. They aren't the skeletons in God's closet, but they're actually skeletons in our closet, and that they're actually God dealing with the brokenness of his world and bringing it to a happy ending. So it's a really good book. I'd really recommend it. For those of you who wonder and question about these things of how could God send people to hell? How could God's judgment seems harsh? the holy, the idea of holy war, whether it's conquest of Canaan or later on, that doesn't seem right. Really recommend this book, and it'd be helpful even to give to those who are skeptical and questioning
right.
on those issues. Skeleton in God's Closet by Joshua Ryan Butler. So a lot of what I'm going to say comes out of the chapters where he deals with the conquest of Canaan.
I really just want to say, like, the Butler did it. I don't know why, but I'm just going to throw it out there. That'll help you remember the name of the book.
Yeah, it's good. It's scholarly, but it's also he's a pastor in a church in Portland. And it's dealing with people's actual objections on the street, you know, that type of thing. Anyway, so the caricature is that the strong, powerful Israelites come in and mow down. They run down these idyllic, peaceful, innocent Canaanites in just a brutal genocide.
In order to get their land.
And to take their land, yeah. Right? But that caricature is wrong on a number of fronts. And I want to point out, how many is there? There's like five things I want to point out. Now, in the end, we're still dealing with a God who judges and opposes sin and judges these people. However, I'm going to say the picture we have is exaggerated or misunderstood. And there's five things I want to point out. So here's the first one. The Canaanites, this picture of it's the strong, powerful Israelites mowing down innocent Canaanites. Because it's actually reversed. The Canaanites were the strong ones. They had large, heavily armed militaries, fortified bases. Israel were weak slaves wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, eating a restricted diet. I mean, this is not the big, powerful guys wipe out the civilians. It's the opposite. It's actually an underdog story. So in our minds, we might picture this big army wiping out the Canaanites. This is actually a pitiful, small group of untrained soldiers taking out big military bases. This is an underdog story, not an abusive oppressor story. And so the Canaanite conquest comes about in such a way that it's clearly not a big army storming through the land, but instead is an act of God providing for these weak underdogs. They don't have the strength to do this.
Right.
They should lose every one of these wars. They should get annihilated. They don't have the technology, they don't have the training, they don't have the military for it, they don't have the numbers, they don't have the power, they don't have the fortresses. There's no way this should happen. It's clearly of God.
And we can see clearly in other instances, just a few chapters later in Joshua, at the attack of Ai, like where when they get it into their heads that they're mighty and they're strong and they just get crushed. And then God comes in and shows them that by my hand. It's the same reason David defeats Goliath.
Exactly right? What I was going to say. This is a David and Goliath story. You don't go, hey, David's a jerk for mowing down Goliath, right?
Right.
Right? This is a David and Goliath story.
Good point.
Okay, so that's the first thing. Is like, let's get it right here. Who are the big, strong, mighty ones? And who are the small underdogs? Okay? Yeah. The second thing is the word city. When we hear city, that this city fell, they destroyed that city, we think of the city we live in, Vancouver. It's full of families, it's full of schools, parks, houses, children, preschools. It's the place that we live. But the Hebrew word for city, and in that ancient context of how they lived and what the cities were, the word city would have pointed to a fortified base, a military outpost guarding a key strategic location. So who lives in cities? In ancient cities, like the ancient city of Jericho or something like that. Who would have lived in that city is soldiers. It's a military base, not families. The city is where you keep weapons and soldiers, military might. It's not where the preschool is.
Right.
So we think of city, we think that's where people live.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say they probably weren't preschools, but...
You know.
Yeah.
It's an analogy.
Yeah, I get it.
So we hear city and think of homes where people live, innocent civilians live.
We think of the suburbs often, right?
Like, we should think of military, strategic military bases, fortified cities, castles,
right?
That type of thing, okay? So, in fact, quoting from the book, Josh Butler's book, he says, all the archaeological evidence indicates that no civilian populations existed at Jericho, Ai, or the other cities mentioned in Joshua. Jericho was a small settlement of probably 100 or fewer soldiers, and this is why all of Israel could circle it 7 times and then do battle against it on the same day. So it wasn't a huge sprawling suburb full of families and children. It was a military outpost. and archaeological evidence would that's where we get that from, is the actual evidence of it. And then he says, so when Israel utterly destroys, quote unquote, a city like Jericho, we should picture a military base being taken over, military fort being taken over, not a civilian massacre. So, and related to that, it's telling that the only non-combatants mentioned in Jericho is Rahab and her family.
Yeah.
And many scholars would believe that Rahab the prostitute ran the sort of the local tavern hostel for the fortress city. She might have been the only one that's not a combatant, her and her family. They run the bar.
Yeah.
And so it's not a city full of
families and
thousands of civilians. She might be the only one. She runs the local pub / prostitution hostel at the local, at the regional fortress.
Hmm.
And there's no other civilians mentioned.
Well,
besides
reality,
Rahab and her family. And God rescues them.
And wouldn't it be that the civilians, that the Canaanite civilians, they'd live farming.
They're farmers.
Their properties all spread out.
So they're spread out all over the land.
There was no kind of urban.
No, it's an agrarian society.
Yeah, there would have never been an urban center necessarily.
Like that. Not the way we imagine.
Yeah.
So these cities, we shouldn't think of them as places where people reside, but we should think of them as military bases.
Right.
Okay, so next.
Helpful.
What about when the text says all men and women, young and old, phrases like that? Well, Hebrew scholars point out that this is a stock phrase, sort of a generic idiom, used to imply totality, everyone. And to Hebrew ears, it does not require that there are actually women and children in the fortress, only that the fortress is totally depopulated. That's the point.
Huh.
That in this victory, everyone, like the city is decimated and there's no one there anymore. So saying that all men and women, young and old, it's sort of like you say the extremes in order to imply everything.
Right.
Well, yeah, and so it doesn't necessarily mean that there were women and children, young and old, you know, being there and being killed. It's just saying no one's there anymore. Take them all out.
And it's Tim Mackey, the Bible Project guy,
isn't
he?
Yeah.
In the Joshua video.
Okay, I haven't seen it yet.
I remember watching it and he had said something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing, but that it's, that phrase is actually, like Hebrew hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like they use it differently than we would in English, but like that it's kind of like an exaggeration. It's a way to just kind of an all-encompassing kind of almost ridiculous term, but not meant to be funny.
So saying that a city had no survivors doesn't require that doesn't mean there was a civilian massacre.
Right.
It was a military win, okay? So the way that phrase used, we have to be careful about it. Or maybe could just in English misunderstand it. The next point, I guess number four, is that some of the language of these victories was exaggerated rhetoric. It was sort of the ancient trash talk of the day. So we shouldn't read them. They're truthful, but we should not read them as precise reporting as much as kind of exaggerated rhetoric. For instance, here's an example. We could say, oh, the Canucks got crushed last night. I mean, they were total no-shows.
Yeah.
But that doesn't literally mean that, like, the Canuck players got crushed like a Zamboni drove over them.
Right.
And it doesn't mean when we say they were total no-shows that they literally didn't show up to the stadium. Like, there was only one team made it.
Yeah.
We're exaggerating the victory or the loss by showing it was a very decisive victory.
We do that in sports all the time. They got beat. It was like men versus boys out there.
Yeah.
It wasn't like grown men literally playing like Noah's soccer team or whatever, right? Like,
so what we use that language in sports to describe victories and losses, and the ancients use that type of language all the time to describe their military victories and losses.
Huh.
We decimated them. We crushed them. We use those things for sports. They would use them in ancient telling. So there's actually these stories they have, and they're in Butler's book, and where Israel's enemies talk about victories against Israel. We utterly decimated them. There were no survivors. Well, clearly there were.
Yeah.
But in their telling of it, the exaggerated rhetoric of their story, they describe it in bigger terms than it really was. So Christopher Wright, he's one of the best Old Testament scholars. He's a conservative, brilliant, brilliant Old Testament scholar. He says this: "We must recognize that the language of warfare had a conventional rhetoric that liked to make absolute and universal claims about total victory and complete wiping out of the enemy. Such rhetoric often exceeded reality on the ground." Now, this is not to accuse the biblical writers of falsehood, but to recognize the literary conventions of writing about warfare. So he's not saying that they're lying, not at all. They're saying true things, but we have to recognize the genre. You know, you read poetry differently than you read a genealogy, than you read a narrative, whatever.
Yeah.
And so the genre of reporting about victories in ancient times included this type of rhetoric of total victory that was exaggerated. And in the sense, the comparison, it's not it's precise reporting as much as it is ancient trash talk. So some of that language we just have to be a little bit careful with, because it reads, if you read it looking for precise reporting, you're going to be a little bit misguided. Instead, we get a little bit of trash talk and exaggerated reporting. It's just the rhetoric of how that type of writing goes. So that's something to consider. And finally, the last thing that we have to consider in all this is the caricature, which is that the kind of agrarian, peaceful, innocent Canaanites.
Right.
And that it's really, really harsh. When the reality is, there's two things to consider. One is the patience of God and the evils of the Canaanites. And so the patience of God, the conquest of Canaan has to be read in light of Genesis 15, when God talks to Abraham and he tells him, you know, you're going to come back. Your descendants are going to they're going to be in this land, because Abraham's in Canaan at the time. But not right now. They're going to have to go. They're going to go into slavery. And he kind of foretells all this, that they're going to go into slavery for 400 years, and then they're going to come out. And it's not going to be now. It's going to be then, because he says the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet complete. And then he goes on to list the other nations that live in Canaan as well. The Amorites are one of the nations that lived in Canaan. What we see is that God sees the wickedness and evil of the Canaanites. And you think of like Sodom and Gomorrah, that's the same people. He sees their iniquity, their sin, their evil, that they need judgment, and yet he's patient with them. He gives them 400 years to repent. Think about 400 years. So we're talking about the year 1616. King James Bible has just been translated. We're not that far. We're 100 years after Martin Luther. Like, think about how long 400 years is. You just read that quickly in the
Bible.
Nothing
in North America was so civilized or colonized.
Yeah, exactly.
Neither the United States or Canada existed.
It's, you know, that like, our nations are not even,
Canada's not even 200 years. United old. States is 1776, so there's still 100 years, 150 years.
So you're talking longer. So the entire history of our nation, double it, and then some. And that's how long-suffering and patient God is with this quite vile and evil people.
Well, yeah, and I think
so. He's not the picture of like he's harsh.
Yeah,
no, he's patient. He's very patient.
When a lot of the laws that we read in Leviticus are in kind of juxtaposition to what was happening with Cain, like child sacrifice.
Yeah,
and some of these.
So that's the second. Things, right? So second, first is God's really patient. Secondly, was he patient with these people? Are truly evil.
Yeah,
and archaeology and other texts and documents tell us we begin to recognize the extent of the violence and evil of the Canaanites. These are not peaceful, idyllic people. And it's a violent empire. So incest, rape, child sacrifice, throwing your children to Moloch, and murdering newborn babies as a sacrifice and hoping to appease the gods so that your crops will be fertile. These types of practices are normal. Bestiality, homosexuality. And not just they do this privately, but expanding, tempting, bringing more people into it, expanding their empire,
celebrating,
spreading their corruption, celebrating this. The Canaanites are horribly evil people and had been for hundreds of years, and their evil was growing and spreading into more and more lands. And for God's covenant people, and it was actually very tempting, because we sometimes go, why is idolatry such a big deal? You know, and why shouldn't they intermarry? You think about cult prostitution, the guarantees of wealth and prosperity, the drawing of them in. They struggled with this stuff and falling into the same prostitution, the same sexual sins, the same idolatry, and the same things for years. And so, in many ways, the Canaanite conquest was a judgment on a horribly evil people after hundreds of years of waiting.
Yeah.
But it was also a protection of his covenant people that he needed to remove them from them being their neighbors. This actually becomes their failure to actually finish the conquest. As we get, when we get into Judges, we see that for hundreds of years, it draws them back into sin, into breaking God's law. And because they don't finish the conquest, it creates pain and heartache for them for generations and generations. So it's, in reality, what feels like harsh is actually right and fair. You know, like, how about all the people clamoring to stop ISIS?
Well,
the great, and we're talking, from the sounds of it, the Canaanites make ISIS look a little bit tame. Well, violent, but also perverse and sexual and all these sorts of things.
Well, and that's really what just popped in my head as you were sharing that, was that this idea of that two of the primary objections that we often will hear from people, critics or opponents of Christianity, is kind of two sides of the coin. We don't like this God who kills, who annihilates people. But on the other hand, we don't like this God who, how can we worship a God who allows
evil, yeah.
Yeah, this kind of evil to exist. And the irony is like, well, which way do you want it? Because he's actually neither of those things. He's not a God who wipes out people,
annihilates the innocent, yeah.
No, nor does he sit back apathetic to the evil that goes on in the world, but he's long suffering and he's patient, and it helps us wrap our heads. And it, to me, it comes back to a podcast we did recently, where a couple weeks ago or last week, I can't remember, but where we're talking about making an image of God, in that, like, when you had mentioned J.I. Packer talking about when we try to make an image of God, we may be saying true things about him over here, but we're excluding true things about him here. And that's the picture I'm getting in my head, is that when we make these statements, we may say, oh, God just seems like he goes and kills people. This is true. God does, not genocidally, but justly. God is just. But on the other side of the coin, if that's all we focus on, that God just wipes out the Canaanites nilly-dilly, we're not getting a full picture. We're actually saying something that's untrue about him in the same breath.
And if you were actually there, if you were like just one of the neighbors watching all this unfold, the question you might have is not, why did God do all this?
What took him so long?
It'd be, why hasn't God done anything about these evil people for hundreds of years?
Yeah.
You know, because they would be wanting God to act and to right the wrongs,
yeah,
and to create, make the world a more beautiful, safe place by removing those who are causing most evil and damage. So what at first seems like harsh and uncalled for, sort of like this genocidal, this being the accusation, is actually, in many ways, could be portrayed as an act of mercy to the world and its inhabitants, for God to, in mercy and justice, remove those who are doing great evil. God ultimately, his ultimate purpose as history moves forward is to remove evil from this earth. And that's a good thing. We want a God who, in mercy, removes evil, and that's part of it. I think the other thing we could say is the Canaanite conquest was not initiated or even really acted out by the Israelites. It wasn't them storming around the ancient world. It was an act of God, his judgment and justice on an evil people, and Israel was the tool for that justice. Later on, we see in the prophets that God uses this nation to punish that nation and that nation to punish this nation, and God can work that way. So what I say that to mean is the Canaanite conquest does not set a pattern for other acts of violence. It was completely of God's initiative and God's completion, and he holds the right to do that. You don't look at the Canaanite conquest and say, we should do the Crusades. No. Right. No. It does. What it teaches us, the moral isn't, we should use military might to bring about. No. The moral of the story is, God has the right to do as he pleases.
Well, and I think when
it's a one-off event, you know?
When these, I find when I am challenged with these types of questions in my own heart, I have to come back to base foundation of who do I believe the Bible tells me God is. Mm-hmm. Who does the Bible say God is, and who do I believe is that he's good, mm-hmm. that he's just, that he's patient, that he's right. Mm-hmm. And so often I think we lack giving God the benefit of the doubt. And so it can be, yeah. it can be a challenge. And sometimes it takes us, some of these questions are, one, need clarity, but I think need to exercise a level of trust in God, mm-hmm. That he's right.
I mean, as you keep going, as we're reading Judges, you realize the failure of completing the conquest, like it says early in Judges, I think Judges 2, and talks about how they fail to complete the conquest, and it becomes the pain that they live with for years. In some ways, you look back and you go, they should have finished the job, but they didn't, and therefore they very quickly fall into the pagan practices, the sexual promiscuity, the prostitution, idolatry, the worship of other gods, and that they didn't do what they were told, and they paid the price for hundreds of years, the period of the Judges.
Well, the book that Steve referenced is called "The Skeletons God's The Skeletons in God's Closet" by Joshua Ryan Butler. Check it out if these are things that you feel like you spend a lot of time thinking about or want some more clarity on. I haven't read it, but Steve has, and it's incredibly helpful, and it's just become on my book list of books to get myself. But quickly before we wrap up, we promised last week that we would tackle a couple more of these obscure Old Testament laws. So I'm going to just throw some at Steve that came in that stood out and see what he has to say about them. The first I'll give you, though, we'll put them together. Leviticus 19 and 27 and Deuteronomy 22:12, and they kind of are about how we look. The first one, you shall not round off the hair on your temple or mar the edges of your beard, which I'm okay with.
We talked about that one, because that's right beside the tattoo one.
Oh, right.
So I think the reason for that is those are Canaanite practices for all of those ones, and they kind of are bunched together.
Oh, right, that is the verse before. Yeah. Okay, and then Deuteronomy 22:12.
Oh, yeah.
It's the one that, reason this always stands out to me, there's a book called The Year Living Biblically, and this guy decided to try to live his life obeying all these laws, and this is one that always stood out in that book. He didn't really get the point of the Bible as he wrote it, but
it's kind of a funny book.
It's more entertaining than anything. You shall make yourself tassels on the four corners of your garments with which you cover yourself. So we got a attach these four tassels on the corners of your garment. And then later in a different passage talks about this specifically. Like, use a blue thread. What is that about? And that's Deuteronomy. Why would God instruct his people to put tassels on?
In Numbers 15, it explains a little bit better. And it says there that it shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, to do them, not to follow after your own heart and your own eyes, which you are inclined to whore after. So you shall remember and do all my commandments to be holy to your God. So their shirt, their clothes, have the tassels that bounce around and bang them on the leg or whatever, right? And they're just ever present with them, and they're just there as a reminder. In some ways, this is maybe a... there could be better analogies if I actually thought about it. But like, you know, some, you wear the "what would Jesus do" bracelet, right, or something like that. Oh, I wear this as a reminder.
Yeah.
Same idea, that the tassels are there as a constant reminder to not follow your heart and follow your eyes, but to follow God's commands. And so he just puts something on their clothes to just bounce around and remind them constantly to follow God's ways. I think it's
interesting.
Yeah. So the motive is that they dress in a way that distinguishes them, but more than that, that they dress in a way that reminds them to keep God first. Yeah.
All right, this next one, I have every time, and I probably read it the first time when I was like 14, so my immaturity took over. But even this last pass through Deuteronomy, it's stopped me dead in my tracks. Made me laugh a little bit, if I'm really honest, kind of going like, that is strange. But made me realize, I'm like, I actually don't really know why this law is in there. This is my passage. If you want to blame anyone, you can blame me. But I just thought this is a weird, obscure kind of rule or law in this very obscure situation, because so many of these laws tend to be situational, like in this situation to this. Case laws. So this is Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 11 and 12, and it says this. When men fight with one another, and the wife of one of them of the one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of him who is beating him, and puts out her hand and seizes him by the private parts, then you shall cut off her hand. Your eye shall have no pity. So there's this scenario where two men are fighting. One, I'm assuming, gets the upper hand, and the wife of the one who's losing runs in to save the day and grabs a guy by the bits and pieces in an attempt to, I don't know what, save the day. Yeah. And her punishment is, lose your hand.
Yeah. What's up with that?
Yeah, like, I mean, aside from, like, the shot to your pride if you're in a physical altercation with another man and your wife has to come and save the day, can you shed some context on that? So we'll do that. That'll be our last one.
So scholars say that there's some, there's a little bit of what?
Yeah. Because it's weird. Let's be honest. Like, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of thing you'd expect.
What's implied is that because of the the punishment of cutting off her hand, what's implied here is that she has injured him, the person. So she hasn't just touched this guy, but has actually damaged him, perhaps in such a way that he can't have children.
Okay.
So it's not just she touches him, this other guy, but actually inflicts damage on him in such a way, permanently. And because there's lots of laws, so she's hurt him in such a way that he is permanently injured and can't have children. One of the reasons why they think that is because the verses immediately before in the context are about levirate marriage and having children. So place this law here along with these other laws about children and not being able to have children, things like that. So there's kind of a flow in a context.
Yeah.
Now in the law, there's lots of laws where there's this whole principle of lex talionis, which is, it means sort of, it's this whole idea of retribution, an eye for an eye. The death penalty. If you kill someone, it's the death penalty.
Yep.
If you do whatever you do, comes back against you, right? And so, why would they cut off her hand? Well, because she has injured this man permanently in an unfair and wrong way. He can't have children, perhaps.
Yeah.
But because
they can't punish her,
her in the same way, because she's a woman.
Yeah.
Different private parts.
Oh. Oh, okay, I get that.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's a thing, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that's how it works.
Interesting. Thank you, Pastor.
In order to find a way of punishing her that would be fitting, the thing is to cut off her hand, which did it.
Right.
So it's a little obscure.
Yeah.
It's a little precise. Like, how often does this scenario come up that we need to have a law about it? But so just kind of based on context, the way these Old Testament laws work, the flow of the laws and what came before it, it seems to be that she has permanently damaged this guy in a way that he can't have children.
Yeah.
And the retribution, the right punishment for it is to cut off her hand.
And let's be honest, there are a few passages in the Old Testament.
It's a little puzzling.
That do this to us, that I think in some ways the 14-year-old you and the new and the adult you are in kind of in a battle, and you're going, you want to giggle and laugh and go, but then at the same time you're also like, wait, what does that actually mean? Why? So that's what that sends out. But if you have other obscure laws that you've noticed or question, wonder about, send those into us, bside@thchurch.ca, or any other questions that you have about faith and life. We thank you so much for your listenership and encourage you to continue on the Bible Project. Keep in your word every day, and we will chat with you next time.